Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You're due for your biannual cleaning, something you usually forget and would rather not remember. But you just got a reminder from the dentist you look forward to seeing. The Gentle Dentist, the only dentist you're happy to come back to. The Gentle Dentist in Worthington. How can we make you smile? Call 614-431-3311.
Can't get enough eye-popping, jaw-dropping, heart-stopping reality TV.
It's the best.
Then head to Hey You, home of reality on demand. Stream and download the latest episodes from shows like Keeping Up with the Kardashians and The Real Housewives, same day as the US.
What's more fun than that?
Or binge old faves like The Simple Life and The Hills.
That's hot.
Hey You, reality on demand. Start your 1 month free trial now.
They watch the movies, slash flicks, slash tracks for the good, slash bad. It's the slash film cast. Who's the girl, slash boys, slash old, slash young. Yeah, we watch till the last of the credits is done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Slash Film Cast, the official podcast of slashfilm.com. I'm David Chen, and with me are
Devendra Hardwar
and Jeff Cannata.
And welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. If you're just tuning into this podcast for the first time, you can find more episodes at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. And today what we're going to do is we're going to discuss some film news, some follow-up from last week, and then move on into what we've been watching this week, just talk about the films and TV shows we've been enjoying, and conclude with an in-depth review. This week we'll be reviewing Finding Dory, the newest film from Pixar. And let's start off by talking about the Summer Movie Wager as it stands right now. And you can get an update of how we're doing at thesummermoviewager.com.
But we were so cocky, Dave.
I was insanely cocky. And now we
ate our fish before we caught
we
them.
We pointed and laughed at Peter Cerretta. We pointed at all the times we had laughing and laughing.
So for those who don't know what we're talking about, we had the Summer Movie Wager, which is a competition where we are trying to choose the correct order of the top 10 films of the summer by domestic box office. And Peter Cerretta, editor-in-chief of SlashFilm.com, made a very controversial choice. He chose Finding Dory as the number one film of the summer by domestic box office. And we all said he was stupid. And we all me, Devendra, Germaine, and Jeff Cannata, we all chose Captain America Civil War. Because, I mean, come on, that is a safe four-quadrant film with a huge, you know, backing behind it. And I was feeling, I got to admit, even leading up to this weekend, I was feeling pretty confident. Because we had seen so many sequels just die on the wayside. You know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Alice in Wonderland, like all these sequels.
Pixar sequels, too.
Cars 2, you're thinking of. I mean, those movies did well financially, but, you know, who knows?
You know what's even crazier? If I had had the opportunity to see Marvel's, the Captain America Civil War, and see Finding Dory before making my choice,
you still would have done
the same thing.
Yes.
Finding Dory it feels like a movie that is a little harder to swallow. Like it has it's more complicated emotionally. You know, it's not one of those feel good films all the way through. It like asks you to kind of feel bad for a little while.
But anyway, the results are in. You know, Finding Dory made a boatload this weekend, but even more important than how much it made in the opening weekend, I think it was like $135 million. Like, that doesn't sound like that much, but it made a ton of money on Monday as well, which is a significant factor in determining how much money it's going to make for its entire run. Some people are not ruling out that Finding Dory will make over $500 million domestically, which is insane. So for
a lot of fish food.
For those who don't know how much Captain America Civil War made, Captain America Civil War made around $400 million domestically thus far, $401 million to date. So if Finding Dory does cross $500 million, that means that Peter Serretta will have jumped into the lead for the summer movie wager.
So just to be clear, this is what we're talking about here, because literally every single other person picked Civil War as number one. This is a 9-point swing.
Yes.
So he hasn't – he won't win outright.
It's not the full game.
Right. Yeah. But it's a massive advantage.
Yeah.
It was a shrewd move because he was literally betting so much on this.
Oh,
and he was the only one of us who had the balls to do it.
It was a bold move, and I salute him, and I also deeply, deeply resent him for it.
So. Well, it hasn't happened yet. It hasn't made $500 million yet, so he shouldn't count his chickens quite yet.
I'm hoping Independence Day Resurgence puts a big hole in that box office take for Finding Dory. This is the only time I've ever rooted so hard for Independence Day Resurgence.
But it's exciting. It's fun this year to be able to follow it in real time, because in previous years, this is the 10th annual, but every other year we sort of just retally at the end of the year and find out a surprise at the end. And it's cool that we have these tools this year because of our awesome listeners that have done this for us.
Agreed.
To be able to keep track in real time and have the roller coaster ride every week.
Totally. All right. Well, Jeff Cannata, you were at E3 this week, right? The Electronics Entertainment Expo.
Yeah.
And how many times have you gone to E3 at this point?
It's funny. Everybody posts their, this is my 12th, this is my 20th, whatever. I've never gone back. I can't remember the first one I went to. It's been many years. I think it was 2000 or 2001. I'm not sure which one was my first, but I'd have to really look back. But it's been a lot of them. I've been to many of them.
Well, you also live in L.A., so that makes it easy, right?
Yes.
You covered this for DLC. That's why you weren't here with us for our Conjuring 2 review last week. But, how did you enjoy E3, and what did you think of some of the major announcements? There are some home entertainment-related announcements that happened this week that we should talk about.
Very much so. This was, especially from Microsoft's end, they were, touting new hardware, which I think will have ramifications for the home theater. The Microsoft, the Xbox One S, or as I'm calling it, the ones. They pluralized it, see, guys, because the S on the end.
I get it.
And their upcoming Scorpio will both have, 4K capability. Sony's going to have a 4K version of the PlayStation 4, although they weren't talking about it at E3 this year. Really front and center were games, a lot of really exciting games for consoles, for PC, for VR, lots of really, really cool stuff. It was difficult for us, Christian Spicer and I on my DLC podcast, it was difficult for us to come up with our game of show. It was a hotly debated one this year. Last year we came to a consensus very quickly that Fallout 4 was going to be our game of show. But this year we had a lot of really strong contenders, and the new Zelda, Nintendo was only showing one game at their show, and they completely transformed their entire large space that they reside in every year at E3 is this massive amount of floor space that they cover. They converted all of that to covering one game, Legend of Zelda, Breath of the Wild, and they turned that space into this sort of Disneyland-esque fantasy world. It was extraordinary, really, really a neat way to do it. So that game was a big contender. The new God of War, which I give a lot of credit to for being a much more mature, interesting, grounded, narrative-based game. God of War, for so long, I've been saying is about boobies and blood, and has been really about this sort of visceral action combat experience with a light sheen of story laid on top. But it looks like this is going to be a video game that movie lovers can really enjoy. It's going to have a deep, rich narrative. It's going to be about sort of shepherding this child through a very hostile fantasy landscape, but it's kind of about parenting, and instead of getting experience for yourself, you're getting experience for this child and teaching this child how to hunt and how to survive. Really interesting take on that game. So those were and the game we ended up awarding was Horizon Zero Dawn, which is also a really awesome fantasy landscape. I can imagine a film or television series in that world. It's a post-apocalyptic, but post-apocalyptic in a way we've never seen. It's post-post-apocalyptic. It's a reclaimed post-apocalypse, so that, you know, we're enough time has passed since the apocalypse that nature has had a resurgence and it's everything is lush again. But you see just under the surface the remnants of a once vital civilization. But now we're sort of back into this hunter-gatherer type tribal culture. But the creatures that you hunt are all technology. They're all sort of robot dinosaurs. It's really cool.
So Microsoft made some interesting announcements, and this is my first time watching E3 without being a part of Microsoft in quite a while. So it's a very interesting experience. They announced two consoles, the Xbox One S, and also an upcoming console that they have not revealed yet called Project Scorpio.
This is somehow a good idea.
It's supposed to come in holiday of 2017. A lot of questions about why they might do that, given that if you're announcing like a future console, like why would you pre-announce like another feature console that might take the wind out of that sales?
Yeah, they literally announced a new update and then made it obsolete 60 minutes later.
Yeah, they were getting ahead of all those rumors because most of that stuff leaked before E3. So I guess they kind of had to like say something, right? So
it's become, you know, the full Appleification of consoles, where, you know, no one says, hey, you made your phone obsolete by announcing, you know, a multiple iterations of your phone in one conference. I think it's the same idea now here with the consoles, where there's a family of them, and your budget and your home entertainment system dictates which one of the Xbox Ones you'll want.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, germane to our listeners right now is potentially the Blu-ray capabilities of some of these Xboxes.
4K
right?
Blu-ray, yeah.
So yeah, the Xbox One S coming out this summer is apparently the cheapest or one of the cheapest 4K Blu-rays you can buy, right?
Now they all cost $400 or more, right?
Yeah, so this 4K Blu-ray will cost $300. But how easy is it to even get 4K Blu-rays at this point,
right? You can get the discs, but also I don't think anybody wants them is the thing. Like, it's a really smart move for Microsoft and really good for, you know, people like us who may really want to invest more in physical media, but you know, I've researched and talked about and written a lot about like why 4K Blu-ray just like probably won't work out as a platform.
Because it's a new format that people then need to buy. Like,
it's a whole new disc. Yeah, you got to rebuy movies. Yeah. They're more expensive than Blu-rays. Yeah. The Blu-ray market is falling. 4K streaming is here and there are more titles available. It looks pretty good. It's only the like hardcore archivists, the people who are like really into Laserdisc, would be into 4K Blu-ray most likely.
Right. Yeah, I think DaVinci's right at that, especially that last point that 4K streaming is here. So
it's here. Yeah,
it makes it a little redundant to get a disc when you know it's so easy to stream something in 4K and it looks really really nice.
Everyone's internet can support it, but you know that's all improving too. So
I just did a search for 4K Blu-ray in Amazon, and the discs that are showing up are pretty diverse. We got Deadpool, we got The Revenant, we got X-Men Martian. Apocalypse, Mad Max, The Martian. Mad Max Fury Road in 4K, I would really look forward to that. But then you also have The Amazing Spider-Man 2, the new Total Recall with Colin Farrell.
Sony is just like cleaning up its recent catalog and like throwing it on these discs.
Yeah.
But maybe, you know, maybe if these consoles both get, you know, have a Trojan horse into the into the living room of a lot of people, maybe we'll see this format have a little more life to it because people will actually be able to play it.
Perhaps it
could end up being like the PS2 DVD situation, because that was one of the cheapest DVD players when that thing launched. But at the same time, like, we are in a totally different world and streaming is so much easier and it's looking better and better, you know, every year.
Because you need a 4K TV as well to be able to enjoy it. Yep. You got to get a lot of equipment, but it is an interesting entry into the home entertainment market that you can get a $300 Xbox One that's much sleeker than the one they currently have and be able to play 4K Blu-rays.
It also doesn't have that that annoying power brick thing. They managed to put that in the box, which I think is not insignificant.
Yeah. It looks great, but my whole thing is, oh man, I got to wait for Project Scorpio, you know.
Same.
I don't know that I'm going to get the Xbox One.
I will not be getting the non-best version.
But how are you going to live with yourself for the next year, guys?
Yeah, would I just get an Xbox One S like a chump, you know, as opposed to
sell it next year? This is not a hard problem to solve, but you know, for people like us. But I think for general consumers, it's a hard thing to deal with, especially when the One S you know, there's not really much of a reason to upgrade, right? Other than maybe the HDR feature.
Yeah, and it looks better games, and it's smaller.
Not every game.
I think, honestly, that, you know, this is much more targeted to people that were holding out and hadn't bought an Xbox One yet.
Yeah.
And now here's a much easier to, you know, put in your entertainment system. You can mount it both horizontally and vertically now.
Mm.
It's much less expensive. It feels like it's targeted toward people that were
It looks
were
like they spent
out.
More than a week designing it, you know, things like that. Like, oh, God.
All right. Well, that's the report from E3. A lot of interesting announcements there. Let's do some follow-up from our review last week of Conjuring 2. Couple things worth mentioning. The first thing is, and again, we got inundated with this correction, which I'm quite grateful for. Again, whenever we get a ton of corrections, I think that's a good thing because it shows people still give a crap about the podcast. But on last week's episode where we discussed Conjuring 2, we talked about how there is a CG character coming out of the Whirligig and how it looked really fake. It looked CG. And a lot of people pointed out that, in fact, that character was not played by CG, or was not done by CG. It was an actor named Javier Botet, who has played a lot of horror film characters that are meant to look really weird and gangly, and he plays the Crooked Man in Conjuring 2. I guess I would say that, you know, so point taken that many elements of him were not CG. I would say, like, there was a scene where he kind of came out of the Whirligig that was done.
That transformation is probably.
He has a very rare disease called called Uncanny Valley disease.
Just. Yeah, so I would say, like, there was, like, some CG use that I would say is probably what bothered me the most. But beyond that, I think our problem was not necessarily the CG used on the character, but just that it felt like a weird-ass character to have in that film.
It was totally really different.
Yeah, it was just quite different than the other sort of scares that were being used in that film. So, but point taken, Javier Botet is a badass, and a lot of that.
I worry about that guy's life, I guess. Like, just walking to get coffee, are people just terrified of whoever this weird dude is behind them?
Apparently, his he can imitate really jerky motion too,
right,
in a way
is,
that makes it seem unnatural. So that's
that like on a physical level, your body just like is reviled by that sort of thing. Like anything that looks so natural, we're talking about Uncanny Valley. They're sort of like that is sort of like an Uncanny Valley.
It is. You're saying it's just frightening to people.
It is like, oh, this is not right. This is not the way the world works. So yeah, seeing that guy in real life would be terrifying.
Yeah, I'm sure he can control it though. But
I don't know, Dave. I don't know his life story.
I'd love to find out. But that's Javier Botet, and he has been in other horror films too, and he's done a great job in them. Also about The Conjuring 2, a lot of people shocked in the slashfilm.com comments about your reaction, Devendra, to Ed and Lorraine Warren. I think for two reasons. Number one, I think just the idea that you, Devendra, a man of science who writes for one of the most respected gadget blogs in the country, might believe in supernatural or paranormal things, I think was surprising to people. And then separately from that, the idea that Ed and Lorraine Warren are not frauds, I think, was surprising. And I think
that is just new information to me.
Yeah, part of the latter is just that Conjuring did such an amazing job of either rehabilitating or just creating an amazing, stoic, admirable image of these two people. You know what I mean? That the idea
the characters in the movie, I think, are much better than the people in real life.
Right.
It's just. Throughout my life, I spent a lot of time reading about like what the Warrens have done and seeing lots of things. I was just really into this stuff. I do understand that, probably most of what they're doing is not legit, for sure.
I
get it.
It is interesting to read about them and to read the scientific consensus about them, which is not favorable, but then to watch these movies, which not only give them the benefit of the doubt, but like the emotional crux of these films is that they are correct. You know, like the film
Their
does not function.
View, everything they say is correct.
Right. The film does not function unless you believe that they are telling the truth.
Right.
And so it's just interesting to contrast that with reality. Mm-hmm. Anyway, why like these movies have been so popular and why James Wan chose to make these movies, it's interesting to contemplate given the real world implications of what they've done. Any thoughts about Paranormal Activities, Devendra? I mean, is this something... I think, you know, we've talked about this before. It's something that you entertain the notion of, right?
I do. I entertain it just because I've definitely... I understand what confirmation bias is. I know like all the reasons why like certain things may not be true. There are definitely things that I've seen in my life that are kind of weird and I can't quite explain. So I just have this little like earmark, like maybe let's go back to this at some point and see if there's ever a scientific explanation for it. But, you know, Russ had mentioned this during the show too. Like he has his own opinions and, you know, he's had experiences too. I think I come down more in the line of like, you know, there is definitely a lot of stuff we don't understand. So I am more of a man of science than anything. I understand that everything has to be proven. But I think I'm more interested in, like, not if that like any of these supernatural explanations are real, but what if like there is some weird scientific way we can explain why some of these elements started happening, right? Like when people started talking about night terrors and kind of how that made you feel and how that also kind of like started explaining the people who thought they were being abducted by aliens or something. That was really fascinating to me. Like seeing how a physical response in your own body can project this idea that, you know, you're being held under your will and these invaders are in your room. That's kind of my big interest in all
of this. Like you're referring to the movie The Nightmare, right? Like that documentary about people who have sleep paralysis and feel like they're under attack, which is like a widespread worldwide phenomenon.
So really, if you don't have science in front of you, you're going to come up with ways to explain that, right? So to me, that's fascinating, seeing how we do that.
Jeff, what were you going to say?
I was going to say that whole... any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic idea. Mm-hmm.
There's that too. I mean, there's so much stuff that we just don't know. And then once we figure it out, that's kind of what I'm waiting for. And I hope we can come up with explanations for all sorts of things. Yeah.
A couple of other updates. One big one is about Warcraft. And Jeff, you and I and Angie talked about this a couple weeks ago about that movie not doing very well. It's a complete bomb in the United States, but somehow has become the highest grossing film that is based off a video game.
And thanks, China.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically due to China. Apparently, 90% of Warcraft's box office came from outside the U.S., which is a really high number. Even, you know, Angie Han writes in this article at SlashFilm.com, even a movie like Pacific Rim, which was kind of saved by foreign box office, only got 75% of its gross outside the U.S. So, the foreign box office really saved Warcraft from being a complete disaster.
It's interesting to me that that puts them in this interesting position of making a sequel, which clearly is going to happen. You know, do you kind of try to retool some things and figure out ways to satisfy the Western audience, or do you just keep doing what you're doing and make this movie for that Eastern audience? It's an interesting problem, right?
Yeah, I don't know that a sequel is definitely happening, but I would say that this first one is not a disaster anymore. You know, but will that lead to a sequel? Who knows? There's been plenty of movies that have been movies that have been saved from disaster from foreign countries like China. Terminator Genesis, another one that did not do well at all domestically, under $100 million domestically, and still made $440 million worldwide. Warcraft has made $39 million domestically. That is really bad. You know, has just cracked 370 worldwide. So
yeah, Finding Dory made that in one day.
$39 million?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
And that day was Monday.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see what happens with Warcraft. But I'm just glad that Duncan Jones doesn't have, you know, a huge black mark on his resume from this, you know. I think his
soul is probably a little crushed, but,
from the negative reviews. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, from that and like the entire project and everything, because this took a while too.
It took several years of the prime of his life. But yeah. I hope he bounces back from this creatively, because I think a lot of people are rooting for him, and I'm glad that it kind of did well to that extent. Anyway, one other thing I wanted to mention, which is that Anton Yelchin passed away this week in a car accident with
freak accident,
really weird circumstances. And yeah, terrifying. 27 years old, this kid, and was a super talented actor who is like up and coming. And I think all of us liked stuff he was in and thought that he would become even better in future years. And like, it's just so shocking and sad and disappointing. And a lot of people are saying 2016 sucks because it has claimed so many people that we admire. I guess I just want to shout out to his most recent role that we've seen, Green Room. He was fantastic in.
So good.
And completely plausible as some guy who sustained the injuries that he sustained in that film and added a lot of heart, a lot of excitement to pretty much every single role he was in. Any favorite?
By all accounts, a gregarious, fun, lighthearted, great guy who seemed to be liked by everybody that worked with him, too. It's really.
Any favorite Anton Yelchin performances, guys?
I mean, I really love what he did with Chekhov in Star Trek. He was an inspired casting choice, and he just had a lot of fun with that role. But that's kind of what he does for every movie, too. We really like the Fright Night remake, and that movie works a lot because of him.
Jeff Cannata, any favorite Anton Yelchin performances?
I saw someone on Twitter, I can't remember who it was, compare his performance in Green Room to Rebel Without a Cause, in the sense that, you know, in a similar way to James Dean, we saw a very young actor who was just sort of showing the potential of what he was going to go on to do, and his life was cut short far too soon. I think Green Room really was that movie of, man, this guy's really special, and he's going to have a bright, bright future, and unfortunately we never really got a chance to see it.
I'm curious to see his role in Star Trek Beyond, which is going to come out in a few weeks. Looking forward to that, and hope it will be a good swan song for him. I'm going to put a movie out there that no one is probably going to say ever. Terminator Salvation, guys. Kyle Reese.
He was in that.
Yeah, he was
in
that.
I remember him in that.
That movie was not very good, but he was pretty good in it. Added a lot of gravitas to that role and as a young Kyle Reese, and that's how good he was, is he could elevate even material like that. So Anton Yelchin, rest in peace, you will be missed, and you were pretty freaking awesome. So huge bummer, but anyway. All right, let's move on. This week, in terms of what we've been watching, Devendra Hardwar, what have you been watching this week?
I saw The Lobster, the next film from the guy who did, what was the name of that movie?
Dogtooth,
that weird Greek film from a couple of years ago, Yorgos Lanthimos.
Yeah.
So this is a strange movie. It's I hope at some point, like, we'll be able to do a full review of it. But yeah, it's basically a world where you have to be in a relationship. And if you're not, you have to go through this weird sort of institute to pair up. And if you're single, it's basically illegal to be single. If you cannot maintain a relationship while going through this institute, you turn into an animal. That is like the construct of this world. And they use that lens to sort of like describe, I don't know, modern day living and modern day relationships and long-term relationships and dating and things like that. It stars Colin Farrell as kind of a sad sack guy who's there. I think his wife leaves him. I don't even know how this is all, because the movie isn't very clear as to like how it's all set up. But sad sack Colin Farrell, which is actually my favorite Colin Farrell, you know, like when he is kind of down and out and kind of pudgy and not super action hero guy, he has so much pathos. And this movie uses him to great effect.
In Bruges, another great sad Colin Farrell performance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just love these performances. But yeah, it basically stars him like trying to deal with this, eventually falling in love with somebody, Rachel Weisz. And I won't say too much about it. It is a weird movie. If you thought Dogtooth was weird, this one I think goes even further. But I actually think it's better for it. I liked Dogtooth. I wasn't like as enraptured with it as everybody else. That was like a weird movie that didn't feel like it had much meaning behind it. There's a lot more going on in this, and I adored it. Great cast, great performances, totally surprising. And I cannot wait to talk about it further with you guys and get into spoilers.
All right, that's The Lobster. It's, I think, out in limited release right now in very few theaters. It's kind of disappearing from theaters, but it will be out on video on demand and Blu-ray in about 4 to 6 weeks. So we might discuss it more then. And Devinder, anything else you've been watching?
I've also been watching O.J. Made in America. Have you guys seen this thing yet?
No, everybody keeps talking about it. I really want to. It took me a while to get around to the FX series, and now I've just finished that, and I'm like, oh, really? I got to do another more OJ?
We're ready. Yeah,
it is an eight-hour-long documentary about O.J. Simpson.
That's a lot of O.J.
I like what Sean Burns, film critic in Boston, said recently on Twitter. If you had told me that my two favorite TV shows in 2016 would be about O.J. Simpson, I wouldn't have believed you, but here we are. It's crazy that we have so much material on O.J. Simpson this year. There's a convergence this year. Apparently this documentary, O.J. Made in America, which I think is airing on ESPN, is a masterpiece.
It was airing on ABC. It is available on ESPN's site, and I assume it's probably airing on ESPN as well.
And on their app as well,
Yeah, and on their app. It is very, very good. I blind bought this on iTunes just because, like, I don't have a DVR and stuff like that. Totally worth it. This is such a compelling documentary because it takes a big step back, and it doesn't just like focus on the personal drama of the whole OJ, the whole fiasco and everything.
Not just the tabloid elements. It focuses also on like the context under which OJ Simpson emerged.
The context of America, what built him up, the context he was raised in. It goes back and, looks at him and like kind of how he got to become a sports star and what he meant and what he represented and things like that. Like this show goes deep. And what is fascinating is that all of it's interesting because all of it, you're trying to deconstruct, what is making this guy tick? Like, how did any of this happen? And to me, it's really interesting to see pop culture. We're sort of using pop culture in a way to, reflect on our history and kind of, explore it and expand on it. The documentary is a very, direct way of doing it. The OJ FX show, I think, was, more of a populist way of doing it. But, whereas that show was, really, really fast-paced, just throwing so many things at the wall. This is a really measured, slow take and looks at the state of America, what OJ meant. It brings up ideas and things I didn't even realize. There's one little anecdote about the first time he met Nicole Simpson, and they went on a first date, and one of her friends just recounts it almost casually, recounts the fact that he basically assaulted her. That admission and talking about that. I'm sure people who've been following this case closely probably know most of this stuff, but a lot of it feels new to me. The way it's put together is really interesting. And they talk to so many people. They got freaking Mark Furman talking on camera about this. So it is tremendously compelling. So damn good. It's a slow burn, but it's genuinely interesting.
Yeah.
When I was watching the FX show and they would, anytime they would show, actual newsreel footage, there was a part of me that wished it was this instead. As much as I enjoyed the performances of that show and appreciated the drama of it, I definitely a large part of me was like, man, I just kind of wish this was a documentary.
That show was theater, and I think great theater in terms of it showing the epic tragedy, I guess, of all of this. This documentary goes deep. It is all the context you need. It is so damn good. It is, this is why I don't really have time for many documentaries, especially really long ones. But this is why I love this format. So seriously, watch it however you can. It's all on the ESPN app and their website. It is, I think, $20 on iTunes and Amazon. It's totally worth it. Just see it.
That's OJ Made in America. And you can access it in many different ways. Let's go to Jeff Cannata. Jeff, what have you been watching this week?
Well, I checked out the new first episode of the new Voltron reboot on Netflix. Did you watch that too, Devendra?
I saw it because the people doing the show come from Legend of Korra, which was fantastic. So
you totally see that DNA in it.
Yes. Yeah.
It's. I don't think it's as good as Avatar: The Last Airbender or Legend of Korra. But it's close. It's close. And it has that same DNA. It's got that wonderful sense of humor, very broad comedy, but done with some intelligence and heart. I mean, the first episode has a very prominent fart joke, full-on fart joke. So it's not exactly, high art.
Yeah.
But
it is very much a Saturday morning cartoon, right? Because plot things just happen and it moves really quickly. It's like, oh, we got to get these kids into these, cat robots so they can form into this big robot fighting thing. But it's so much fun. It is definitely not like on that level, but I have a lot of fun with the show.
Yeah, I agree. It's, you know, I think Avatar: The Last Airbender and Legend of Korra work on a very adult level. Like, everything mm-hmm. really is grounded and makes sense and has – there's threads that are established and paid off and all that stuff. Voltron, not so much. As you said, there's a lot of stuff that just happens. There's a lot of you know, how exactly does all this work? Why, you know, when we're all in a big robot together, what are we doing?
It's
exactly?
almost aware of the fact that this is all ridiculous, but in a fun way, yeah.
But the characters themselves are really fun and silly, and there's lots of great humor to it. I mean, I actually laughed out loud a few times watching that first episode.
Yeah,
The action sequences are really well done, which is what you want, you know, out of a giant lion robot action cartoon.
Traditional animation, too, which is, I feel like, something we're just not seeing as much these days.
True.
And, like, I know people really like that Star Wars Rebels show, but one of the things holding me back is the fact that the CG they use in that show just looks awful. I can't, like, as somebody who appreciates animation as, like, an art form, I cannot look at that show. It is very nice seeing traditional cell animation.
I agree. Very much so. Yeah, and it's done well. It doesn't look cheap. It has the same quality that, you know, the last
the same animation studio as Korra too. Like the best one. Yeah.
You definitely can tell. It's good stuff.
That's Voltron episode 1. It's on Netflix right
Voltron,
now.
Voltron Legendary Defender, Dave. Get it.
My bad. I apologize, gentlemen. And it's on Netflix right now. And before we continue what we've been watching, we should say we are going to talk about the most recent episode of Game of Thrones, season 6, episode 9.
Sure.
So if you don't want to be spoiled on Game of Thrones, probably skip forward a few minutes. But this was a major television event this week, and so we got to talk about it, guys.
Yeah, you get on your own show to talk about it.
Yeah,
that's right.
But Devendra and I decided we have to crash your party a little bit because you can't not talk.
You can't
about
not
it.
Talk. No, I agree. I was like, hey, if you guys want to talk about this, I totally support this because it was so insane what happened this week on the show that it's like a television event, pretty much.
Yes,
you know, that must be acknowledged.
I would go so far as to say maybe my favorite fantasy battle sequence ever put on film.
I think
even compared to Lord of the Rings.
Yes,
like that,
I think
probably
it's
the best one
than
so
the,
far. Yeah,
I think it's better than Helm's Deep. I think it's better. I was trying to think even much larger budget things like those films. I think this outdoes them on almost every level. Like
the Saving Private Ryan of that sort of battle. And it works on that level too, I think.
Yeah, it absolutely is as emotionally resonant, as the stakes are just as high. The pure logistics of what you're watching feel epic and grand in scope and scale. The fantasy elements are really well done. The special effects are incredible. The photography is awesome.
Directed by Miguel Sapochnik, by the way, who did Hard Home last season. He did a couple of their episodes too, and he directed Repo Men, which is a weird ass sci-fi movie that we all really liked because it's such a weird ass sci-fi movie that somehow turns into like a kung fu movie by the end.
I don't remember us really liking that, but you know,
I really like that movie.
It was definitely really an interesting movie. This is the new Repo Men, not the Criterion
we
Repo Men.
We geeked out about like just how insane that movie.
It
was
pretty nuts.
Yeah, that movie goes all the way. And I just love seeing him work with the Game of Thrones universe. Like I think the level of technique we're seeing here in terms of like how he put some of this stuff together. I love the way the battle starts extra wide, you know, as these battles tend to do. And it evokes claustrophobia in such a great way, like towards the end, like just sheer insanity, the insanity of being on the battlefield like that. The idea that Jon Snow basically is just a really lucky idiot because he does exactly what his sister tells him not to do. So good. I think it's really well put together.
The episode starts at 11, right?
Yes,
we start
yes.
with the best dragon battle we've ever seen in the show. And somehow that's not even what we end up talking about. Like
that's just your appetizer. Yeah,
exactly. They managed to one up that by the end. But that sequence was thrilling and awesome and something we'd never seen on that scale before in this show or really in anything. I mean, I can't think of another dragon. what was that Sean Connery dragon movie? Dragonheart.
Dragonheart. Yeah.
That didn't even do it. Or so, and not just dragons versus tanks. What
rain
was that
of
movie?
Fire, man.
Yeah.
Come on.
Entertainment Week. So, firstly, there's a anatomy of a scene video on YouTube and HBO Go that you should check out that kind of describes how they made this. And Entertainment Weekly also has some really phenomenal coverage this season of Game of Thrones. They interviewed Miguel Sapochnik. And here's my favorite part from that interview. The question is, my understanding is that adding horses makes everything harder. What was the toughest part of that? Answer from Miguel Sapochnik, the time factor. Everything takes about 50% longer. Also, they need relatively solid ground to run on, and when it rains, the field would turn into a bog, and we'd have to lay down tons of gravel to shore up their footing. Jeez. Horses also get bored and spooked, and some perform better than others. They also need an entirely separate field to rest in. Oh, and they shit and piss all the time. In fact, one of the hardest scenes to shoot was the parlay between the different factions prior to the actual battle. Getting a bunch of horses to just stand there all day and do nothing is much harder than getting them to run around. They would fart and pee a lot, often in the middle of star Kit Harington's lines. Wow. End quote. Hearing the logistics of how they fed 600 people, you know, and with hundreds of extras and dozens of horses, and just for 25 days, they just did.
This is Mark Ronson with his incredible new album, Late Night Feelings. Featuring the hit singles, Late Night Feelings and Nothing Breaks Like a Heart. Mark Ronson, Late Night Feelings, out Friday.
This was just their whole life was doing this.
Isn't that a show that they just know how to spend their money right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Yes. And I keep comparing – I've been having a lot of discussions about the Warcraft movie lately, and I keep comparing it to Game of Thrones because there's no point in that series where I don't feel like those are real people in a real place mm-hmm. wearing real clothes. You know, like it doesn't feel like cosplay. And – I would guess that the Warcraft movie costs an order of magnitude more and yet doesn't ever feel as authentic and grounded and real. And that's not just because of the CG, because there's plenty of CG in Game of Thrones as well. Mm-hmm. It's the way it's shot. It's the way it's cast. It's the way that the lens through which we look at that fantasy universe. Yeah. And they've nailed it. It makes it feel like an actual thing.
They know the aesthetic they're going for. Like, one of my favorite shots from the entire series is in this episode. And that is, like, Jon Snow just, like, stepping up, unsheathing his sword, and, like, facing this horde of,
so
like, horsemen.
So good.
So good. So and you good. Would think that's CG. And apparently, no, that's, you know, that's a real shot. And,
yeah.
like, hopefully those horses don't trample him by the time they get there. But so damn good.
What about the shot of the Onion Knight standing on that pyre with the, like, the sunset
the
behind
man the sunset
that's I want a poster of that
it's everything. Pretty good. You're talking about Davos, right?
Davos, yeah. After he finds the doll. So much good stuff. I also like we're basically in spoilers at this point.
We would spoil everything through season 6, episode 9.
I am very glad we're done with Ramsay Snow Ramsay Bolton, just because I as great as the show is, as like I don't know, interesting and nuanced as it can be, he is probably the worst aspect of Game of Thrones. Like, he represented like all the like the violence and the cruelty, but there was never any nuance to him. He was never anything more than just like, you know, a cackling villain. And the actor is very good. I really enjoy him. He was in Misfits. He's a good guy in Misfits, although kind of a crazy person there too. I love him. I just wish like Ramsay Bolton just like became such an overwrought and really, I don't know, just really comical villain this season. So, yeah, glad we're at least past that. I just wish they had done more with him.
I also, my biggest gripe, I think, is that Rickon was completely wasted.
Did he have a single line this season?
Run away from an archer in zigzags, man. You fucking
hide behind the pyres. You do something. But something with your life.
Even taking that away, like, here's a major character, a Stark child, who had no purpose in this entire series other than to die to motivate Jon Snow. Like, I gotta feel that in the books there'll be more with Rickon.
I hope
than the TV show is doing, because he really was. There was literally no part of that saga that he has any part of. It's such a strange lack of anything for him.
He's just a plot pawn, basically. But yeah, in terms of like other things that annoy me, it's I guess I hate like when something is this good and you sort of see the plot machinations kind of show up. Like, Sansa, tell your brother that you have an army come. Just tell him. You're sitting there, you're yelling at him about, you know, not listening to you, which is totally valid. But at the same time, you know, that's when you tell him. And then, yes, he's
maybe
dumb
she
enough
know
to do exactly.
Maybe
I mean, she probably didn't have at least say, hey, I sent this thing. Who knows?
There's what's a chance.
There's you a know, chance. Wanna, maybe delay a day. Maybe hold off.
You don't want to get somebody's hopes up for it.
That's hilarious, Jeff. But yes, I agree with you, Devendra. There are some interesting plot machinations that were not fully explained or not explained well. And if you want to hear me talk about that for like 80 minutes about why a lot of things didn't make sense about this episode, check out my other podcast, Cast of Kings, at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. But in the meantime, guys, we can all geek out about how freaking awesome this episode was.
So freaking awesome.
Fantastic.
It was amazing. And just like I felt as I was watching it that I was watching television history be made about – like no battle has ever been attempted at this scope, you know, this expensive with this much skill. It just was amazing. So
the other thing I learned is if you're going into battle, always bring a giant. Always.
Giants help.
Except, yeah, Jeff, I felt more for the death of one than I did for Rickon, which I don't know.
Oh,
that,
I know.
Yeah, I don't know that that was
loved one
intentional. Yeah,
that, no one helped him. Help him.
they all think he could take care of himself, but he can't. But just the progression of that battle, the way that you end up seeing how everything takes formation. Just tremendous.
Yeah, and apparently John almost dying and suffocating was improvised by the director.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was not like written in the script. He just was on set, and they had to just come up with something on the fly. And he's
okay. Those mountains of bodies. Yeah. Like, do something interesting with that. Jeez.
Yeah, pretty good stuff. So that's season 6, episode 9 of Game of Thrones, Battle of the Bastards. And if you're not caught up with Game of Thrones, definitely catch up to get to that episode because it is amazing. So. And I think that's all in terms of what we've been watching this week. Let's move on. Before we get to our review tonight of Finding Dory, let's thank all the people that donated to this podcast. Thanks to Sophie from Oslo, Norway, Steve C. from Southfield, Michigan, Colin S. from San Jose, California. That's Colin with a K. Tobias M. from Berlin, Germany. And thanks to Naushad Hussein for subscribing at the rate of $2 per month. Thanks so much, guys. If you want to support the Slash Film Cast and help us defray the costs of seeing movies and putting on the show, you can go to slashfilm.com, click on the Slash Film Cast tab, and use the PayPal links on the side of the page. And that money is going to come in handy this week because they are not screening Independence Day Resurgence for critics. no critics that we know. You know, there's a few critics like Hollywood Reporter and Variety got to see it early. But usually they screen movies for critics for free so we can, you know, get ready and do the review in time for the movie to come out. Not happening this week. Very curious. Very curious.
Think of your podcast hosts as they pay for this movie.
Very curious because they've screened like everything else this summer.
Yeah.
Alice Through the Looking Glass, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. They screen everything.
How bad is this movie? just how bad is
it? That's what's so baffling is I've heard it's not even that bad. I've heard it's just okay, you know? But we will be reviewing that movie next week, so look forward to that and appreciate your donations in support of that review. Let's get to our review right now of Finding Dory.
Did you hear that?
What was that? Hear what?
Stan, I heard someone say hello.
Yeah, there's a lot of fish here. Anybody, literally anybody could have just said hello.
Hello? There.
Where am I looking?
There.
Oh.
Hi, I'm Dory.
Yeah, well, where are your parents?
Hi, I've lost my family.
Where did you see them last?
I forgot. I was looking for something, and I... Okay, totally get it. Date night.
I suffer from short-term memory loss. It runs in my family. At least I think it does. Where are they?
Dory, there you
are!
Look out!
Ah!
Oh, look at this.
Our friend got taken into whatever this place is.
It's a fish hospital.
I feel fantastic!
Listen!
Dude.
Name's Hank.
That was from the trailer of Finding Dory, the newest film from Pixar. It was directed by Andrew Stanton and Angus McLean. Here's the plot summary from IMDb. The friendly but forgetful Blue Tang Fish reunites with her loved ones, and everyone learns a few things about the real meaning of family along the way. So Finding Dory is a sequel to one of Pixar's most successful films ever in terms of critical reception as well as box office. Finding Nemo earned almost $1 billion worldwide. It cemented Andrew Stanton as a filmmaker to watch. And this is this movie now comes in an era when Pixar seems to be cranking out a ton of sequels of varying quality. And you know, I think the last movie we saw from Pixar was what, The Good Dinosaur, right? Mm-hmm. I think, and that was a movie that we weren't too sure of. It was one of their less successful films, and so I feel like it used to be a situation where every single Pixar movie, you'd be like, man, this movie represents quality. It's going to be amazing. It's going to make you cry. It's going to be
that movie came right after Inside Out,
yes,
in the same year, right? And that is that example of like the premier Pixar.
Yes,
I agree. I think Inside Out is in my top two or three animated movies of all time.
Definitely,
I think it's a masterpiece.
Definitely flagship Pixar, but the record has been not as flawless. It's still incredibly good. I mean, they still turn out amazing films. But I feel like there's been a few films here and there that have not been as great. The question is whether Finding Dory would turn out to be one of those masterpieces like Toy Story 2 and Toy Story 3, or if it would be a film that it's less easy to get enthusiastic about, like The Good Dinosaur. So Jeff Cannata, I mean, were you a fan of Finding Nemo? And if so, did you find this a worthy follow-up?
You know, I feel like I do a little bit of a disservice to our audience. As you mentioned earlier in the episode, last week was E3 for me. It was a very, very busy week. I fully intended to go back and rewatch Finding Nemo before seeing Finding Dory. I really wanted to have that experience, but I never got the chance. And excuse me, I feel really bad about that because I barely remember Finding Nemo. It's not one of those movies that I've watched a million times like other animated movies, and I'm sure there's a lot of people in our audience who have watched that movie a million times. So there, you know, and there's a lot of Finding Dory that kind of fills out the backstory. I mean, the movie starts, I think, right in at the end of Finding Nemo. It is in a lot of ways. Well, it actually starts before that.
It kind of retcons.
It catches up to the
end. It's a year later. A year after, I think.
There's a lot of stuff that happens in Finding Dory where I was like, is that new information or is that explaining why that happened in Finding Nemo? And I honestly couldn't remember. And I feel really bad about that. So I'm not going to be the one of the three of us that is able to compare those two movies because I remember loving Finding Nemo, but it wasn't one of those that I liked so much that I came back to over and over. Mm-hmm. And I barely remember it, to be quite honest with you, and I feel bad about that. Anyway, I've said that enough. I think Finding Dory is very good. I didn't come away from it thinking it was great. Mm-hmm. But I think it's very good. And that's, you know, when you're in the realm of Pixar, that it's almost you damn it with faint praise because they're, as we've said, their bar is so high. Their median quality level is off the charts. And I think this is on the high end of their quality level. This is a very good experience. But I think it suffers from what a lot of their movies suffer from, and that is trying to be a servant of a bunch of masters at the same time and not really coming together into a whole that felt particularly a home run to me. I think the movie at its best is when it's talking about raising a child with special needs. You know, having a big budget mainstream animated film that's really about a special needs child and the challenges of being a parent to a special needs child, I found to be very powerful, very moving. And those moments when the movie it really embraces that and is about that and is about how you encourage someone with special needs to, you know, find autonomy and actualize in a world that is difficult for them, I found that to be really moving and really, really interesting and nuanced and well portrayed, and it gave me insight into what that must be like, right? But also the movie wants to be this rip-roaring kind of silly fun ride, as animated movies are, and I think when it's doing that, it's less effective for me. There's a whole bunch of characters that kind of move in and move out and are introduced willy-nilly and very conveniently, and things
problems arise and the solutions just sort of drop out of the air instead of feeling earned. Mm-hmm. And I never felt, you know, there's, like I said, I don't remember Finding Nemo well, but a lot of the plot of Finding Dory is expressed through flashbacks. She's remembering things in ways. And I felt like a lot of those remembrances were really convenient. And it didn't ever feel like the predicaments we find ourselves in had clever solutions. They just had convenient solutions that weren't exactly deus ex machina, but were just sort of like, well, this is the next thing that needs to happen, so here's an easy way for it to be accomplished. Here's a character that we can introduce that's fun and silly and entertaining, but also is magically the right key to our whole, you know? And I found that to be less satisfying and less enjoyable than, say, Inside Out, which feels like all the solutions to the problems are established in really interesting ways and are paid off surprisingly, and you don't see it coming, and oh my god, you know, Bip-Bop or whatever his name was, you know, that moment is so powerful, and it just, like, it all made sense that it all worked. This just felt a little convenient, but again, a good movie, a very good movie, even certainly one that will be satisfying to a lot of audiences, but I honestly thought that the short at the beginning of this one was better than the movie itself.
So good. So
yeah.
Good.
Yeah, the short was pretty good. It was a lot better than Lava, I'll say that much.
I liked Lava, but I thought this short was just beautiful.
That is some amazing sand animation going on there.
Their environmental technology has just gotten so far, like so deep that they have to actually make the characters look more, like, not real, like purposefully not real, right? Because they could create photorealistic animals at this point.
Devinder Hardwar, your thoughts on Finding Dory?
I'm actually pretty much right along with you there, Jeff. Like, I honestly didn't even think to rewatch Finding Nemo ahead of this, because that was a movie I liked just fine. I feel like I remember the basic points. But it isn't one of those Pixar movies that I feel the urge to revisit for whatever reason. Like, it's just not a movie that really connected me with whatever level. Maybe if we were parents, guys. Maybe, Jeff, like, after your child is born, you'll love these movies more, as some of our critics like to say. But yeah, this, you know, so yeah, I like Finding Nemo just fine. I wasn't too excited for this one. And yeah, I found this to be pretty solid. This is definitely among the better Pixar movies. I love the idea that, yeah, you have the main plot of Dory trying to find her family and everything, but it is about more than one thing. And that is the best part of some of these Pixar movies. Like, that is the thing that The Last Dinosaur, or The Good Dinosaur, that's what that movie lacked. It just didn't quite know how to convey something more than, like, the very basics of its plot. And yeah, I like the idea that this is a movie that can tell, that tells people, like, not only with special needs, but if you have, like, any sort of flaw, right? A physical flaw. Like, everybody, nobody's perfect. Everybody kind of has something that they have to deal with to live a fulfilling life. And I like how the movie just portrays, like, several characters trying to deal with that. We have, you know, one character who's just very afraid, I think, of being around public or being in open spaces. That's the great new character in this movie, Hank the Octopus, played by Ed O'Neill. So much fun. But yeah,
can I say one thing real quick about that?
Yeah.
Am I the only one? I liked Ed O'Neill, and I think he did a great job, but I thought his voice was hard to distinguish between he and
J.K. Simmons?
No. No.
He sounded exactly like him.
Albert Brooks?
Yeah, Albert Brooks.
Really?
Yeah.
I really thought they were much too similar to be in the same movie together.
Stop me if you've heard this one, guys, but have you guys recently seen a movie where a blue tang fish who's forgetful teams up with the neurotic other sea creature to find family members who are missing?
Yeah.
It's very similar to the plot of Finding Nemo.
I mean, yeah.
But, and they sound like their anxiety sound is the same.
A little different. Like, I guess what Ed O'Neill was doing is, like, much angrier. Like, there's a big anger to his character, and I kind of love the way they use him in certain pieces or in certain, like, situations. He also leads to, like, I think some of the bigger problems of the movie. Like, some of the last act stuff gets super wacky.
Yeah.
And just as much as this is a kids movie, like, it's sort of like the Up situation, where the very end of that movie also felt like it goes a little too far into sillydom. But yeah, overall, I really like this movie. I like the messages it's trying to say. Also, the ideas of that, the idea of having family beyond just, you know, your immediate family too, that's sort of touched upon. Yeah, and it's interesting too. Like it's sort of, it almost feels like very different than maybe the ideas we've heard championed from some of the Brad Bird movies, you know, which have been more and more about exceptionalism and like, you know, being the best at what you're best at. I like the idea of sort of embracing your flaws and trying to like live with it because everybody has to deal with something.
I enjoyed the movie Finding Dory. I thought it was middling Pixar.
You sound tired by this movie.
Yeah, I do. I think just because, firstly, this is a movie that's obviously doing really well. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of people love it, and I you know, on a
it doesn't
basic
have much
level,
staying power for me.
On, like, yeah, on a basic yeah. level, like this is not a, you know, I could see myself watching Finding Nemo dozens of times in the future.
Right,
if I ever have kids, I could see myself like revisiting that movie over and over again. And this is not a movie I feel any desire to go back to.
Right.
Just because, as I've mentioned, it revisits many of the same territory that Finding Nemo already did and in some ways did better. You know, Finding Nemo was about this overprotective father who had a son who was differently abled and then had to kind of learn to let go and let Nemo be his own creature. This movie has many of the same ideas and also has that kind of like neurotic guy teaming up with Dory to find someone. Amy Nicholson, I thought, had a brilliant review of this film, which is that it's very dark and it makes more sense. The movie makes more sense if you assume that Dory dies in the first act and that everything else is just like the afterlife.
My version of this think piece thing is I think it's a movie about a time traveler.
How so?
Dory is a time traveler, and she's trying to piece together this experience she's already had. And she's like, time is reconstituting itself, and she's messing with time because that's constantly what's happening in this movie is that she's like bouncing back and forth between what has happened and what hasn't happened. And anyway, I think there's a think piece to be written there.
I think I agree. There's a pretty interesting element there. But the idea I think that Amy Nicholson was trying to convey in her review at MTV News was that the movie is really freaking dark, you know, after the first act. And I think you were talking about earlier about how it's kind of sad. It makes you feel bad, but it's just dark. Like the marine sanctuary is portrayed not it's portrayed as an act of good from humanity, but also as a prison. And there is a scene with a like aquatic petting zoo that is absolutely terrifying. You know, if I was a child watching that, I would be like, is that me doing the thing that is on the screen? You know,
that's... right. And also like ruining that experience for a whole generation of children, you know, like
they'll never look at aquatic petting zoo the same way
that.
Again.
Like, I don't even think they have the ability to look at that and process like what this could mean for my own actions. So
I don't know about that. I mean, kids are a lot smarter than you might give them credit.
No,
for.
No, it's more about that emotional capacity, I guess. But I mean, compare like we've seen really dark shit in Pixar movies, like just the opening of Up and kind of what that, you know, that montage and that opening represents. I didn't feel that as much in this movie. It definitely goes deep. It just didn't feel super dark to me.
I think I agree with you guys basically about this film, and specifically what Jeff said about the movie is at its best when it's conveying this idea of how to be a parent when your child is differently abled or has like a specific struggle that other people don't have.
Really, any paranoia you put upon your children too, which is like Nemo's father learning that whole thing again.
Right. And I agree with you, Jeff. Like, I did find that stuff really great. I mm-hmm. was technically impressed with a lot of the movie. Like, it looks amazing. All the water stuff. Yeah.
I'm sorry. You were about to say this. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah. Well, just all the stuff that takes place in and near water looks spectacular. Like, the reflections, the skins mm-hmm. of these creatures. It looks fantastic. It's very immersive.
And different water looks different. I thought that was so cool too.
Yep.
There's different waters, you know, like when we're in the marine aquatic water, it's a different water than the sea water, which is different than fishbowl water. You know, I thought that was so impressive.
Yeah, it was very good. But I found its shortcomings were A, revisited much the same territory, and B, I was not as engaged by the kind of adventuresome elements as I was in Finding Nemo. Like the sequence with the jellyfish in Finding Nemo, I still remember how tense I was in that scene. And I don't think I felt that tense in this movie. Part of it is because of how goofy this movie is. Like, it's just kind of a silly movie.
Super cartoonish.
Yeah, very cartoonish. And like the ending, I feel like makes me question. It made me question like whether I should be watching these movies and enjoying them as an adult, to be honest. Like, it made me
People died on that highway.
Yeah, it made me retroactively wonder, like, were Pixar movies always this silly and I just was too young to realize it? Or
some of them
is this just really silly? And so, you know, for those reasons, this doesn't enter into like the stratospheric level of Pixar perfection for me. Mm-hmm. But there is a lot to like here. I enjoyed the film. It just wasn't one of my favorite Pixar movies. So,
I just wanted more from those seals, voiced by Idris Elba and Dominic West.
Yes,
who I want more of the Wire X's, just like being silly cartoon animals. Just great stuff.
There's definitely a spinoff, you know, cartoon for those guys in the making. You know,
let's talk about spoilers, guys, because I have a lot of things to discuss with you. Let's get to spoilers for Finding Dory starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
You're gonna see this coming.
No,
but you won't find it because, of course,
you're not gonna see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret.
You want to be fooled.
There's a lot of troubling concepts.
Does echolocation work like that? I don't think it does.
It's a superpower.
I think it does, Jeff.
Sure.
I think it does. It works like Daredevil's ability to, quote-unquote, see it does.
I mean, in the context of a kid's movie like this, like, eh, yeah.
It doesn't require water in any way at all.
Sound bouncing off of things.
All right. Okay,
yeah,
sorry.
Whatever.
I'll be quiet now.
Here's some troubling.
Like, there are bigger problems, but yeah.
Here's some troubling ideas in this movie, gentlemen. Firstly, as I've already mentioned, the petting zoo, like those kids are terrifying.
I can see your existential crisis there, Dave, because I don't know what you did at fish petting zoos. I wonder if you're having like retroactive guilt right now.
For sure, certainly, yes. Like that they were not only didn't want it, but that they were terrified by being touched by humans. That's traumatizing. And here's another thing that's traumatizing. At one point in the movie, Dory gets tossed into a bucket full of dead fish.
Yeah. Yep. And that's weird.
And
that's
there's all dark. These dead fish. And then the dead fish look horrifying. Like, they're very scary that she's in this bucket of dead fish. And they get thrown out in order to feed this gigantic whale, I want to say, named Destiny. Mm-hmm. And you almost think that Destiny is just going to eat them all, including Dory. But then it turns out that Dory is friends with Destiny. Like, they were childhood friends. They were pipe buddies. But what is not addressed is the idea that Destiny is still eating all of Dory's friends.
Well, you know? Yeah, and it's the equivalent of a Disney movie having a human being thrown into a place with a bunch of corpses.
Yes, that's right.
That's the equivalent. It's like Snow White had to hang out with a bunch of dead dwarves for a little while.
And then find out that your childhood friend actually eats people like you, really.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is never addressed again. So
I do wonder, like, in this world, right, they know that other fish have to eat other fish. That's the law of the underwater jungle. It's like the lion.
Well, there's a
but
sequence,
that bucket is terrifying. Yeah.
There's a sequence right at the end where a little fish gets eaten by a bigger fish, by an even bigger fish, and then they all thankfully get regurgitated somehow. But there is a moment where it's like, oh, they all eat each other.
Yeah. So I will also say that in Pixar films, generally, whenever a non-human creature interacts with a human, it does feel transgressive. Like when you see Toy Story 1, and it's like humans have their own world and toys have their own world, and never the twain shall meet. And when they do meet, the results are freaking horrifying, including at the end of that film when Woody starts talking with that dude, what's his name, Sid or whatever, and he like puts a real scare in him because, wow, that is frightening whenever the imaginary Pixar world interacts with the human world. They're never supposed to meet. And Toy Story 2 took that a little bit farther when I think the toys were able to alter the flow of traffic underneath some traffic cones and walking across the street and stuff. And I was a little bothered by that, but I'm like, okay, well, you know, whatever. It's just one scene. It's not a big deal. Like, okay, so the toys can cause traffic accidents. Fine. This movie is on a whole different level when an octopus can apparently sentiently drive a truck through the highway.
Still needs directions, but yeah.
Still needs directions from a fish who can communicate clearly despite being in a Nalgene bottle.
Well, octopuses are very smart, you see, so...
They are.
So I felt like it was one step too far for me in terms of being able to take this film seriously.
Even before that, there's a whole sequence in a baby stroller that is disturbing on multiple levels because they're going through the human world, and then there's a moment where two women look at the stroller and the octopus is pretending to be a baby in the stroller, and they're horrified by it.
Have you ever seen a really ugly baby, though? Like,
does it look like an octopus, Devendra?
Like, I don't know. Some babies, man.
So, anyway, whatever. We're talking about a company that made a movie with a flying house and
talking dogs
and all that stuff like
that. Also, that bird that they imprint
the,
on.
The emotionally disturbed bird, yes.
Which, for whatever reason, speaks bird and doesn't speak animal.
Well, I actually wrote an article about this at slashfilm.com called The One Thing That Bothered Me About Finding Dory, which is that there seems to be a hierarchy in the movie between talking animals and animals that don't talk. And the animals that don't talk are stupid, and it's okay to make fun of them.
Guys, this goes back to early Disney, guys. This goes all the way to the beginning, right?
Follow the money.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about Mickey Mouse. I'm talking about Pluto.
Yeah, he's right.
But it wasn't okay back then, Devendra, and it's not
totally
okay today. It's not okay today.
That bird got totally Plutoed.
And the other seal that can't quite talk.
Gerald, I believe is his name.
I felt bad for Gerald, but I also loved it every time they yelled at him.
No, but didn't you guys think
we're
it was
part of the problem?
Yeah, I mean, didn't you guys think it was kind of troubling that
it is weird? Yeah,
that the whole movie is about celebrating differences, right? Mm-hmm. It's about hey, people who are like that is a major plot point. This idea that Marlin, I would do things this way. But that has often led to failure. I should try things another way. Like maybe I should consider different perspectives.
Yeah.
But for some reason, it's okay to make fun of the stupid animals and get a laugh out of those people.
To the movie's credit, though, like that bird whose name I forget now.
Yeah, Becky, she does end up saving the day.
She and I think Nemo makes a very good point too. Is like just freaking have a little faith in her, or she abandoned us because like you didn't believe she could do this. So.
Yeah, and also if you stay the after credits, Gerald. Gets the last laugh as well. But
I found him to be much more problematic because he's clearly got some disabilities, right? Gerald is clearly, you know, he's
coded to be like disabled.
Hey man, he's just a little cross-eyed.
Or at least like intellectually challenged at the very least.
And they are clearly just bullying him.
Yeah, they're just bullying him. It's just bullying.
Yeah.
It kind of upset me, you know. I just watching it. I just
Well, for all the Geralds out there,
because everyone was laughing. That's the thing.
Right.
Everyone was
and
laughing.
As you're saying, it is in direct opposition to the central theme of the movie.
Yeah.
Which in a different movie, it's less of an issue, right?
Yeah.
But here's our main character is learning that he can't just say that's all you'll ever be, right? And yet, these other two characters are actively discriminating against this. This poor seal.
Yeah.
Laws of the jungle, guys.
Pretty rough. And the only other thing I'll say about why this movie is a bit problematic is just that I find the depiction of Dory's disability to be pretty inconsistent. You know that the idea I think is that like just try hard enough and you can overcome. This disability that you have, it kind of calls to mind the theme of like a beautiful mind in that way.
Right.
And I think it's a great message to say, hey, if you are differently abled or if you have a disability, that you can still live an awesome and fulfilling life. I don't know that it's the same thing to say, hey, you can basically overcome any disability you have if you just try hard enough.
Dude, but, I completely agree with you.
But that being said, you know, maybe this movie gives hope to people who are differently abled, you know, and if so, I don't want to say, like, therefore the message is wrong. Like, it's not it's not really my place to say whether the message is good or not.
It's hard to say that. Yeah, it can't. I don't think any movie can really apply to everybody, right? Like, to everybody who may have some slight issues that they have to work through, but if they, like, figure out, you know, some tools and better ways to live their lives or something, like, they can work through it versus somebody who's, you know, kind of has – they can't do much about it. So –
yeah, but the fact that you have a character whose problem is that she doesn't remember things, and then the key moments to her – accomplishing anything are when she does remember.
Yeah,
it would be the equivalent of if you had a character whose legs don't work, and then at certain points in the movie he can walk.
But she's remembering long-term memories, though. Like, her only problem is short-term memories. So I feel like, at least in terms of the basic rules, the movie is showing us, like, all those flashbacks. Yeah, they are very convenient for sure, but long-term memory, at least based on what we know so far, does work a little differently. So there are, like, the memento people, I guess.
Yeah, that being said, there are moments when she remembers things, you know, like sometimes she forgets what just happened, and then other times she doesn't forget what just happened. So
it's quite hard to write for that. It is
very difficult to write for that, and that's why there's not that many movies that have that as a major plot point.
And I think the movie kind of does lip service to giving problems to a lot of people. Like, Destiny is nearsighted, I guess. But for what? Like, there's nothing pays off from that. She just runs into the wall a few times, and then
she's brave. She's just brave.
I guess.
Well, she does get to overcome the nearsighted fear at the end of
the film. It's really the entire movie is really about overcoming those fears, whatever is holding you back. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think it's problematic when, you know, the depiction of Dory's disability is so inconsistent. You know, like, if it was super consistent, then it's like, okay, I can see you have a thesis and you're advancing it. But because it just is, like, when the plot demands it, it's more difficult to kind of see the point they're trying to make or to root for that point from my perspective.
The movie has a lot of great qualities. My favorite characters in the movie are Dory's parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They are phenomenal. I just love their positivity, their can-do attitude and spirit. I think the movie, it's a little weird that we are convinced that they're dead at one point.
That you didn't need to do that. Yeah.
Right.
Why even step into that territory? But okay.
I don't understand why we needed to go there. Like, we could still be looking for them, or, you know, or we could get to a point where we don't think we're going to be able to ever find them, but to, like, convince our main character that they're dead is a little odd to me. But I loved their approach to her and their positivity, and then we even get that moment behind, you know, when they're alone or they think that they're not being overheard when they're expressing some fears and doubts, and that felt all very real and
totally
genuine to me, and I loved those characters.
And, you know, there's one moment in every Pixar film that really tugs on the heartstrings, right? And at least one. Often there's many moments. And in this movie, it was the moment when there's the camera kind of cuts to a wide shot and you see all the different shells, like, going to that location that they're at.
So good.
That is an emotional gut punch, and nothing we've said thus far in this review should be considered, you know, negating how effective that moment was.
Right.
So anyway, so mixed bag, I would say, in terms of Finding Dory. A lot of good stuff, but some stuff I wasn't.
I think it is mostly good, and then lots of nitpicks. So,
yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. It just wasn't a home run in the way that, you know, the best of Pixar are, and especially you know, everything now to me is compared to Inside Out, because I just think that movie is truly a masterpiece.
It's so good. It's so good. Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's going to wrap us up for today on the Slash Filmcast. Stay tuned to hear what we'll be reviewing next week. In the meantime, Jeff Cannata, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
Well, if you want to hear me talk more about my adventures at E3, we did 3 episodes about E3 from E3 and all involving all the stuff we got hands-on with. That's at the DLC podcast. You can find that at 5by5.tv/DLC. I also do the We Have Concerns show. It's a comedy show about science. You can find that at wehaveconcerns.com. And Tomorrow Daily is a show about tech that I do on CNET at tomorrowdaily.com.
How about you, Devendra?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/Devendra. I write about tech and gadget.com, and I was on This Week in Tech this week, so check that out on twit.tv.
Yeah, good one. I listened to it.
Find me at davechen.me. See my film at theprimaryinstinct.com. You can also see The Primary Instinct on Hulu. Next week, we'll be reviewing Independence Day Resurgence, a movie that none of us is looking forward to, but that because it's the major release this week, we are planning on seeing. So
we're doing it for you guys.
We're doing it for you.
For America, guys. Indeed. We're doing it for America.
Thanks for
tuning
in.
We will not go silently into the night. We will see this movie, whether we want to or not.
This week will be our non-independence week.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Independence Day.
All right. Anyway, thanks for tuning in. Find more episodes at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. We're out.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.